Welcome to There Are Other Ways, conversations about living life a little differently. I'm Fiona Bowers, a brand storyteller for small creative business. Hello! So this is episode 6 of season 2. Before we get started, I just wanted to let you all know that I'm taking a mid-season break next week, so there won't be a new episode up next Monday. But I will be back on the 22nd of October and there will be another 6 episodes in this season. Also, I just wanted to remind you that I'm holding a workshop at Oak Tree Barn just outside Bristol, which is owned and run by last week's guest, Vanessa. It's a brand storytelling workshop. So if you have your own creative business or would like to and are keen to learn how to describe what you do in a way that really connects and resonates with people, then please do have a look at the workshop on my website, www.fionabowers.com. Okay, that's all the admining. So on to this week's episode. It is with author and life coach Beth Kempton. I first came across Beth through her first book, Freedom Seeker, and she's just published her second, which is all about the Japanese philosophy of wabi-sabi and living a perfectly imperfect life. We chatted all about her journey to get to where she is now, what drew her and continues to draw her to Japan, and how important it is to admit and let yourself be a beginner. I took so many useful nuggets away from our conversation, and I'm sure you will too. Hi Beth.
Hi Fiona.
How are you?
I'm so good. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
You're welcome. I'm really looking forward to learning a bit more about wabi-sabi. Is that how you say it?
Yes, wabi-sabi. So wabi-sabi. A little bit more about our sound, but yes.
Okay. Brilliant. Well, perhaps we could start with you introducing yourself, say a little bit about who you are and what you do and how you are living life a little differently.
Yes, hello everyone. I'm Beth Kempton. I'm a writer. I'm the founder of a company called Do What You Love. I'm sure I'll get to talk about that in a minute. Okay. I am a Japanologist, which means I'm a Japan specialist by scholarly research. And I am a mama and I am a life coach. And as a person, I describe myself as a wanderer, an adventurer, and a seeker of beauty. And those are the things I really try and do as often as I can in my life. And in terms of how I live my life differently, I think I've really lived my life quite differently since the age of 17, when something quite major happened, which took me off the normal track, I guess. And since then, I've tried very much to just follow the next interesting thing, do what I love, do things that really bring me alive. And that sounds really obvious, but it's absolutely not the normal way of doing things, as I've discovered over the past few years. But I'm grateful that I've lived that way because it has sent me down many twisty, winding tracks that have been fascinating.
Amazing. Can I ask what it was that happened at 17? I can edit out this question if you don't want to answer it.
No, of course, that's okay. Fine. There's no such thing as a question I won't answer.
Okay, good.
Yeah. What happened was I was a very academic student, and I was, after various pieces of advice from parents and teachers and all those things, I was doing far too many A-levels, and I was on track to go and study economics at Cambridge and then become an accountant, and I had a very, very clear path mapped out ahead of me. And then I got the opportunity with my sixth form college to go on the Cutty Sark tall ships race, and I was on a sail training yacht going from England to Spain across the Bay of Biscay, which was thrillingly dangerous. I actually left a will in my bedroom. I think I left my Sony Walkman to one brother and my bike to the other, thinking I wouldn't make it back. And we did actually hit a massive storm, and it was my first real big sailing experience. And that was terrifying, but we came through it fine. And there was a moment after the storm had passed when everyone else was below deck because, you know, everyone was exhausted, and I was at the helm on my own. And the sea was like a mill pond, and there was just nothing except for some dancing dolphins and me and this big ocean.
Wow.
And I had this real moment of clarity. Firstly, that I wanted to feel like this, how I felt in that moment, which was that I was part of something bigger than myself, and that life was a real adventure, and it was a beautiful thing to be experienced. And at the same time, that I didn't want to be an accountant, and I had no idea what I wanted to be, and that was okay. And all those things kind of happened in this, like, really like a lightning flash. And I carried on with the race and came back home that summer, and suddenly all of my plans were gone. And I didn't know what to do, but I was really excited about what was ahead. So I obviously had no idea what I was going to do at university. And all I knew was I wanted to have an adventure. And so I figured out the best way of having an adventure was to study a language, because you get to go and live overseas for a year. But at this point, I'm halfway through my A-levels, and no university would accept you for a language degree if you hadn't studied the language at A-level, and it was too late for me. And the exception to that was if you decide to do something insanely difficult, like Japanese, Chinese, Arabic, or Russian. And so I did Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Mo, and I landed on Japanese. And I went to Durham and did Japanese, and I literally knew not a word. And we had 1 hour a week of grammar in English, and the rest was completely in Japanese. Wow. By Japanese teachers. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done, but amazing. I actually nearly failed my first year. I was really bad because I didn't know how to learn the language. But I went to live in Kyoto in the second year with the family who spoke no English and had a very, very strong Kyoto dialect. And realised I had to figure it out to survive, basically, and just completely fell in love with it. And that decision, which wasn't really a decision, it was kind of a almost leaving it to chance, going, let's just see what the universe offers me, has led me to so many opportunities that I could have never planned. And nearly everything, looking back, somehow is connected to that moment when I just went, I'm not going to do what everyone's telling me to do. I'm just going to follow my heart.
I think it's really interesting that happened to you so young, at the age of 17, because I think a lot of people I talk to have had a moment like that, but it always tends to be a bit later on once they've kind of gone down the path, and it definitely was for me as well. They've kind of gone down the usual path and got a job and been living in a big city, usually London, and working for a few years before they have that moment when they're like, okay, I don't want to do this. So I think it's really interesting you had it when you were that young.
Yeah, it's true. I never thought about that. But I wonder if it's something to do with my parents, because my mother has always been, she's a primary school teacher. She's always been very heavy on education and the value of it and everything. And my father is an entrepreneur who, you know, he didn't do A-levels and he's always had his own business and always said to me, you don't have to work for anyone else, like since I was really, really young. And so I've had those two very, very different opinions in my life all the time. And I think that's been a really healthy mix of ideas, because I do really value education, but I don't think, you know, university's for everybody. And I think it's, you know, there are other ways of learning as well. So I think that's been really beneficial.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that especially at the school I went to, university was very much sort of a non-negotiable. It's just what everyone did. And I'm really, really pleased I went. I absolutely loved it. But I do think that a lot of people go because it's just what's expected of them, and they don't necessarily want to be there, or they want to be there for the wrong reasons, and that just means they end up in a lot of debt for nothing, essentially, and they don't really get anything from it.
Absolutely. I think you have to just do what is right for you. And that there are, I mean, when I was at university, it was free, and I was given a grant to go and study overseas. That was amazing. I think given the financial situation now, there's other questions, like if I was to, you know, say your parents are able to support you financially and you don't have to take it all on as debt, we think, well, what could I do with that money that's really valuable? And if you started a business at 18, you know, you're 4 years ahead of someone who's just come out of uni. So I think it's not to say don't go to uni, but it's to say that you have so many more choices than are sometimes shown to you. And I think also there's, you know, partly the responsibility is on us as individuals to go, what can I do? Not just let's ask the one careers advisor who may have been out of the career system actually for 20 years, whatever. You know, just go, what do I know from what I'm seeing in the world and what I feel I can offer the world, and what do I need to learn? I think a big danger of the world we live in now is that we expect to know everything straight away. We expect it to be perfect straight away. We don't like to be a beginner. We don't like to fail, which is inevitable if you're trying something new. And so I think being open to all those things and committed to your own kind of lifelong learning journey is really helpful.
No, I completely agree. So before we kind of like go back to sort of Japan and Japanese culture, what happened? Let's just finish your story. So what happened after you left uni? You spent a year in Japan, and then I presume you went back for another year.
I did. I went back for 2 years, finished my degree, did well in the end because, you know, I'd fallen in love with the language, which helped. And I actually went back on an amazing program called the JET program, which is Japan Exchange and Teaching Program.
A couple of my friends did that.
It's really fantastic. And it's run by the Japanese government, and most people go as an English teacher. I actually went as something called a coordinator for international relations, which you have to have a degree in Japanese to do it, and you essentially are you do lots of cultural programs and you interpret for, you know, visited, like, I remember the governor of Colorado came to visit my prefecture because they were sisters, states, and had to interpret him at karaoke and all these kind of crazy things that happened, and translating and things. But it was a really amazing opportunity because that year I was living in a really remote place in the snowy north of Japan.
Whereabouts?
A place called Yamagata.
Okay.
Which means the shape of the mountains. And
is that on Hokkaido?
No, it's not. It's on Honshu. So if you look at a map of Japan, yep. And you've got the main big island, it's in yep. The north of that. So okay. Not, Hokkaido is obviously the top north yep. island, so it's not as far as that. But it's snow a lot of, you know, from I think probably about November all the way through to about April. It's got fantastic skiing. For as cold as the weather is, the hearts are warm, the food's amazing. There's a very strong dialect. It's actually really funny, when I left there, I moved to Tokyo to work and trained at the a national television training centre because I thought I wanted to be a TV presenter in Japan. And I walked in and the teacher, it seems like open my mouth, she's like, oh my goodness, you sound like a country bumpkin. This accent from the locals where I've been living. But I went to work for a year on that program in the local government, and I've just always had this sense in Japan, possibly because it's quite rare for a Westerner, still even today, for a Westerner to speak Japanese well. And there were just so many opportunities. I remember my supervisor said to me one day, is there anything particularly you'd like to do while you're here? And I said, oh, I'd love to be on the radio. I think that would be really a real challenge, but interesting. And he was like, oh, I don't know anybody in radio, but let me have a think about it, which is always a really good sign. It means a Japanese person's going to go away and kind of tap their contacts and help you out. It's really nice. And he came back a week later and he's like, oh, I've set up a meeting. Come with me. And I went with him. And we went to meet the head of this TV station. And we ate cold noodles together, and then I walked out of there with a TV program. So I had a TV program here called Beth Nichols and Friends. Beth Nichols is the main name. And it was literally me and all of my friends, foreigners who lived in where we lived in this north part of Japan, in Japanese, which was quite a bizarre experience, talking about our lives in, you know, in Japanese communities. And that, I mean, that was a brilliant thing. And it was just kind of one thing after another, really. And after that, because I'd done quite a lot of volunteering over the years until that point, at big sports events in Japan. Mm-hmm. So I'd worked at the, I was actually a paid job, but at the Nagano Olympics in 1998, I was supported the British bobsleigh team, who were the only team to get a medal at that Olympics for Britain. So lots of random jobs like that. And I, you know, always put myself forward for like the World Games and all these different things. And so I had a lot of really good sports experience. And so an opportunity arose to go and work at the FIFA World Cup, which in 2002, which was between Korea and Japan. And even though I was only like 24 or something, probably less than that, I ended up with this crazy portfolio of every single team hotel in Japan. So all of the camps that all the teams would go to, and all of the official team hotels during the tournament, and negotiating, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of hotel contracts in Japanese. Just this crazy job, because there were so few people with right experience to do it. And I'm incredibly grateful to my boss, who was Mexican and spoke no Japanese, who gave me the opportunity. He was like, I like you, I think you can do this, off you go. And I think so often those people are like kind of gateway angels. Yeah. And I do that in my life. Like when we interview in our company, it's very much what's somebody's potential, not just what's on their CV. And out for those kind of helpers, I think it's really important, because they can make a huge difference to you shifting on. I think I've only had one job interview in my whole life, actually, but I've had a string of amazing jobs, mostly because people saying, well, how about this person, or she'd be good for this, or whatever. And then obviously I set up my own business, so you don't need any job interviews.
One of the many, many benefits of working for yourself.
Yeah. So then from the World Cup, I had a whole, I ended up coming back to England and doing a master's in Japanese. And then again, feels quite random, but wasn't. Got a phone call out of the blue when I was a student from UNICEF headquarters in New York saying, would you like to go work at the 2004 Athens Olympics, looking after the education program at the Olympic Youth Camp, which had come about by a, through a connection from a previous job. And so much of this is just being open and keeping good relationships with people and staying in touch with people. And then when these opportunities come about, often you get recommended for them. So that's what happened there. And that led me into a whole several few years working in international development for UNICEF as a sports specialist. So I ended up working with Manchester United, with lots of really famous athletes, and then on London 2012's Legacy Programme, the International Legacy, and then I ended up being the head of global legacy planning for England's bid to host the FIFA World Cup in 2018, which was an absolute disaster because everyone at FIFA was corrupt. They took money and gave it to Qatar, as has been proved by the FBI. So that was really interesting, a really amazing series of roles that happened kind of serendipity and connection, and then just this massive moment of kind of disgust at the sports industry when that vote happened. When we had done an amazing, like the football community in England had just done the most incredible job to put together what would have been an amazing World Cup that would have a really great impact around the world. And the people at FIFA, not the technical people, they're amazing. The staff at FIFA are fantastic, but the people in charge who vote for who gets it were so corrupt, it was disgusting. And I realised that to go further in that career, I would have to keep working with people who I just did not agree with their morals, and was really disillusioned and realised actually maybe it's better to be out of big machines and actually to people. And then at the same time, I found myself at this art retreat in California. Again, quite randomly, I read a book. I don't know where I got the book from, by an artist, and she was teaching at this retreat in California, and I just kind of booked it and suddenly found myself on this aeroplane going, what are you doing? Why are you, paying? What you doing? It's just a strange experience. But when I got there, it was like in the shadow of this beautiful redwood forest, and there were 100 amazing American women really excited about just making stuff. And again, it was that feeling. It was like, I want to feel like this in my work. And right now I don't, because I work in a very competitive, money-driven sports industry, even though I'm on the international development side. And it's very male-dominated and really different experience. And I realized that all these women who were incredibly talented would go back to their homes all over America or Europe or wherever they come from and probably do nothing with their creativity because they had no idea about business. And so I think that was also a bit of a light bulb going, well, you could help them bring, got from working with massive brands and help them take their creativity and turn it into a thriving business or career choice. And so those two things happened at once, literally in the space of a few months, the kind of my own creative awakening and also this massive disillusionment with the industry that I was working in. And I just decided to give it a go on my own, and I set up my company, Do What You Love. And that was nearly 10 years ago now. And we set it up in the middle of the big global recession. Sounds kind of crazy, but actually I think it was perfect timing, because I think a lot of people started to realize, like, why am I giving my life and my hours and my skills and my talent to people that are probably going to make me redundant, that are squeezing more of me without being grateful for it, and actually what am I using those skills and talents to put out in the world? Is it something I really care about? And so more and more people have been looking for that, as well as technology developing brilliantly in line with that, so that we can now give people really fantastic educational experiences wherever they are in the world. So
I definitely think that it is there's definitely a real trend towards it. I mean, obviously there's so much now being spoken about, and obviously there's lots of so many people doing it, and then also so many more people talking about it, which I think is again sort of fueling it, because suddenly you're seeing that there are more options And that there are other ways of making a living than working for someone your entire life. And so it's kind of, I think it's going sort of exponentially in that sense.
Yeah, it's very interesting when you work in this arena, because I think you could surround yourself with a community of people who are having similar conversations, and you feel like, oh, the whole world is going in this really great direction. And then you kind of look up from that and you realize that actually the average person in the supermarket or walking down the street is, you know, who the person is stuck behind the bank window looking really miserable. They aren't accessing that kind of information, and they don't have those conversations in their life, and they don't have people around them showing them that there are other ways of doing, of making money, of making a career, living, you know, building a flexible lifestyle to support your family and all of that. And so sometimes I feel really hopeful and sometimes I feel quite despairing. And it's really hard to gauge actually how much this conversation is proliferating. And I think there's still huge opportunity for more of it. Because when people discover us or people in our, you know, circles, you can just see this light bulb come on for them. And they're like, oh my God, you literally, by living the way that you're living, you're showing me that I can live not necessarily the same way, but a way that I want to live. And of course we can. It's not easy. And, you know, there's always obstacles, but you absolutely can. And I think sometimes you just need to hear that from someone. So I love that you're doing this podcast, because it is so important. It might be the one thing, the one conversation that has given someone the confidence to go, actually, I don't have to accept that promotion that's going to give me more stress and keep me at work longer and all those things, or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think that that's true. I think it's, I would definitely love that. And I think for me, a big part of it was, as you say, that there isn't just, because I the only thing I think back to is I think back to when I left London and left my job. I mean, this was sort of three and a half years ago. I thought the only option was to be a digital nomad, to be a travel blogger. Like, that was sort of the thing that I was seeing the most. Mm-hmm. And I ended up sort of going down that road and then realizing it wasn't actually for me. But as I was doing that, I was discovering that actually there were so many other ways to earn money and to build a business that could still be location independent, because that was something that I really wanted at the time. So I really wanted to just kind of have conversations with lots and lots of people who are doing it very differently themselves. So you've kind of got all those different options.
Yeah, and the brilliant thing is, the more people who do it, the more people need services to support them to do it. So in the way that you support small businesses to tell their brand stories, you know, that job wouldn't exist if there weren't the small businesses who need to tell their stories. And the more people who are doing it, the more people can be supported by the services that they need. And so I think you're absolutely right. It's like looking at what can you see is happening, and then think about, well, what's the next layer of that? What do those people need? And can I offer them that, you know?
Yeah, it's like a little sub-economy in some ways, I think, sometimes.
It is. I hope one day it becomes the economy, but I think that's a long way off yet.
Maybe one day. Mm-hmm. Right, so first of all, you wrote, your first book was called, is it The Freedom Seeker or Freedom?
It's called Freedom Seeker.
Freedom Seeker,
yeah.
So I'm adding
it. Yeah, singular.
So can you tell me a little bit about that quickly, and then we'll move on to your next book?
Yes, so the subtitle of that book is Live More, Worry Less, Do What You Love, and that's really what it's all about. And it was very interesting for me, because it came about at a time when I had obviously built this business, Do What You Love. I have two business partners. I'm co-founder of MakeArtThatSells.com and MakeItInDesign.com, and they very specifically help artists and designers to build flourishing creative businesses, and they were doing incredibly well. And I think we got stuck in the trap. I say we, because my husband also works in our company, and we have a team of people based all over the world. And I think we'd kind of got sucked into not following the money at all, but feeding the thing that was making the most money, which is very easy to do when you've got salaries to pay and all these things. Like, that's doing really well, let's do more of that, without necessarily checking in to, you know, back to why did we set this up in the first place? Who are we trying to serve? What is it we're trying to give them? Just doing more and more of this of the stuff that's doing really well. And so I think what I discovered is, when I set up my company, the Do What You Love part was me and my ideas and my teaching, because on my website, dowhatyouloveforlife.com, I teach some courses and I speak, I do workshops, so, you know, I do my podcast, I now write these books. And so there's a whole chunk of our business which is my thoughts about how to live and how to, you know, do things in the way that you want to. And that had kind of got buried, and my life had been really taken over by supporting these other businesses, really in the kind of behind the scenes as a producer. And also we were living in Brighton, which is a beautiful but very expensive city in England. And I had a baby, a toddler, and I was very heavily pregnant with a second baby. And I just had no time to myself. I wasn't looking after myself. And I think I felt really, really trapped, which made no sense at all because I've, you know, been really conscious about making decisions to do what I love. And so a series of things happened, which I talk about in the book, but essentially I realised I needed to create some space in my life, even just a tiny bit, to kind of get my sanity back. Mm. And because I was just about to have a baby, I ended up taking 5 months off, having taken, I think, 4 days off the first time around, which I would not recommend. It's not something I'm proud of. But it's hard when you have your own business to take a big chunk of time off to have a baby. But I managed to negotiate with my business partners 5 months off. It was summer, and I spent this glorious summer kind of pushing my baby up and down Brighton seafront, thinking about what had just happened to me. Like, how did I end up feeling trapped again when I'm so good at feeling free? Like, that was basically that decision at 17 was all about how do I feel free? And I've been kind of following that until this point when I stopped following it. And so it became this really big question. And I actually, although I wasn't working, I reached out to my online community, which was still buzzing, and asked people that I knew in it, you know, has this happened to you? What happened? What was the trigger? How did you get over it? And all of this. And I got hundreds and hundreds of responses and realized that there was a pattern to escaping when you've trapped yourself. And it felt to me like it was a big enough conversation to be a book. I wrote a book proposal just because I like having something, my brain likes something to do. And I literally was doing nothing other than looking after my children, having been super busy. And it, you know, so I put this proposal together and sent it around to a few friends just as a sense check. And my husband sent it to an old school friend of his who's a literary agent. But she represents novelists, so it was certainly not like, will you represent me? It was like, you've seen lots of book proposals. Is this a sensible one? And she was phoning me up and she's like, I want to sell this for you. It's excellent. Who's your dream publisher? I was like, what? That's me with baby brain, not back at work yet. And she's like, yeah, it was amazing. And ended up getting a book deal before I came back from maternity leave with Hay House, who had been my dream publisher for that book, and wrote this book in the next 6 months and really wrote myself free writing that book. And now, having written a second one, which is with a different publisher actually, I think that that whole experience was both to free myself and to obviously tell the story for anyone else who, and give some really important, powerful tools for anyone who's feeling trapped, but also to learn how to write a book so that I could write the second one. Because the second one, Wabi-Sabi, Japanese Wisdom for a Perfectly Imperfect Life, is something I've been carrying around inside me for 20 years. And if you, you know, having heard my story, you'll probably notice that I had a detour away from Japan with all the sports stuff I was doing. But it's been such a precious part of my life and really informed the way I live. And so this was an amazing opportunity to kind of come full circle and bring it back in. But I don't think I could have done that without having written the first book and done all the life coaching stuff before. So I think a really important message there is that nothing's ever wasted, and you don't know when it's going to come back in your life. But all these things are really precious and important.
Yeah. So why did you decide to write a book on Wabi Sabi?
Well, a few reasons. I absolutely loved the experience of writing my first book and realised I basically want to be a writer. Like, that's the other things I love, and I'm going to keep my business going. And, you know, it's the reality of being a writer these days is that you can't just sit in a room and write books, right? You have to be out in the world as well. So my business really supports that brilliantly. So that's fine. But I really wanted to write more. And I sat and had lunch with my agent when she'd actually been on maternity leave when my first book came out. So we gathered together about 6 months after that when she came back. And she just said to me, so what's the next one? And I said, I have this idea, but I think I need about 5 more years life experience before I could do that book. And I shared it with her. And she's like, yeah, sounds amazing. You're probably right. Have you got anything else? And then, as so often happens, the thing that you kind of throw in at the end of the conversation is the thing. And I said, well, I've got this idea that I've been thinking about really for about 20 years, which is that there is so much buried in Japanese culture that – People who don't speak Japanese don't get access to, or even if you visited Japan, often you'll have a sense of something, but you can't quite articulate it, because whether that's a language issue or just, you know, sheer time immersed in the culture teaches you these things. I think there's something really important there, and I think that now is the time, because we have become so obsessed with chasing perfection in our image and comparing ourselves with other people on social media, and kind of always pushing for more and better and faster and all these things. I think we've come to a really unhealthy place. And the truth is, there's many parts of, you know, Japanese life and society that are exactly the same as that. You know, this isn't something just in the West. People who live in Tokyo are also incredibly busy, compare themselves, look on social media, all these things. But there's a lot in the kind of lasting traditions in Japan that have been around for hundreds of years, and things that are buried in the language and culture that perhaps you don't even notice unless you almost have to be a foreigner with a level of experience of the country to see it, because there are things that are so intrinsic to Japanese people in the way that they live. And I think there's something that could be shared there. And I also had realized that wabi-sabi, the word, which has been for a long time used in the West really as an adjective to describe kind of wonky teacups and stuff, had been completely misrepresented, and actually was a much deeper, beautiful philosophy, and that nobody was talking about that. And so it's very interesting. I said this to my agent. She was like, that is it. But the time is now, and you need to do this right away. And so we pulled the proposal together very, very fast. And what was interesting is we had a huge number of publishers interested, but the one that we went with, my commissioning editor was actually looking for a book on wabi-sabi, because she's very sensitive to trend. And even though it kind of makes me kind of shiver to think of wabi-sabi as a trend, the truth is the design world has picked up WGSN, the world's biggest design trend forecasting agency, chose it as a global design trend for 2018, which is kind of crazy when you think about it as being a philosophy rather than an actual design thing. But it was an amazing opportunity when you were trying to get a story out in the world. We didn't discover that actually until the book deal was signed, but there was definitely something about wabi-sabi, like in the zeitgeist, you know, that, although this book could have been written any time in the last 20 years, there were so many things, including my own life experience, coming together at this moment to allow me to write that book. So I'm kind of grateful that I got to write it, because I think it was going to be written by somebody. So I'm glad it's been.
I guess it's also part of that trend of books about ideas and philosophies from other countries. I'm thinking of I can never know how to pronounce the word, but is it Heike? There you go. And Lagom as well. There's been a big influx of books about that as well. And I think I love them. I think they're really interesting, learning from other cultures and what, you know, and taking the lessons and what they have to teach you. So there's definitely a trend for that as well, I think.
Yes. And, you know, this is the reality of the world that we live in. Publishers need to know, the more they know that a particular format is working, or, you know, like colouring books went crazy. If you'd pitched an adult colouring book 10 years ago, people would have been like, what are you talking about? And then now it's, you know, it's like the single, I think like 2 years ago, it was the single biggest contributor to income for publishers, you know. And so there is definitely something about timing for confidence from publishers. But it is interesting, though. I do think there's something about, there's a lot more interest in Japanese wellness anyway. I think I said to my husband about 2 years ago, I think there's something coming to do with Japanese wellness, and I don't know where that came from, but you know, we've had Shinrin-yoku, forest bathing, and the Ikigai book has been incredibly successful, and I just think that we all want to do the best we can with our lives, and sometimes if the tools that we have at our disposal aren't working, we want to look elsewhere to find them. And why not, you know, if there's particular things about our culture that really work for those people, then why not learn from it, you know?
I think it's really interesting that you said that Japan also, because I mean, my own experience with Japan was that it was quite divided, in the sense that there is a side, as you say, Tokyo, where, I mean, you get on the underground there, and everyone just looks ashen faced, that you know, they just look absolutely awful. And obviously it's a lot of very hard work, and working ridiculous hours is sort of the norm. And it's very, you know, the shopping district in Tokyo is absolutely insane, and there's that real sort of like, you know, it's as materialistic as anywhere else in the, you know, as anywhere else in the world. But then there is also this other side to it, which, you know, I mean, I was a tourist there. I was only there for a month. But it's that you do sort of begin, I began to sort of see it. But as you said, I couldn't quite grab it, because I didn't speak any Japanese, and it always felt like a little bit out of reach for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you open any guidebook about Japan, and nearly always say it's a nation of contrasts. It was a huge question for me about nature, for example. You know, since industrializing after Second World War, Japan has put so many scars on its countryside with electricity pylons and nuclear power stations and all these things. You know, it's killed. The Japan that Matsuo Basho, the famous haiku poet, saw and wrote about, it's not there anymore, you know. And at the same time, it's absolutely true that Japanese people really, I think at their heart, see themselves as part of nature, just intrinsically. And I asked some Japanese friends about this, and they said it's really interesting. They're very coy about it and saying it's really kind of embarrassing conversation for them. But really what's happened is since the war, they've been told by the powers that be that, you know, we need to industrialize this, and they've seen lots of good things come out of that from them, you know, for their parents. And after a lot of poverty, they've been flourishing and having a lot more kind of good things in their lives, and that they really, really trusted authority. And then since the 2011 Great Hanshin earthquake, and obviously the tsunami and the Fukushima nuclear disaster, they've really started to doubt a lot more of what they've been told, in the way that we kind of just have always not trusted our politicians. I think there was a much higher level of trust than previously in Japan, and that people are really starting to question things a lot more now. But it is true, absolutely. And you know, I've lived and worked in Tokyo for 3 years or something along the way, and I used to eat midnight ramen regularly on the way home from the office. You know, I worked crazy hours, and for me, part of that was a real adventure, because I was working crazy hours in a foreign country, so it didn't feel like being at home. But I think that what's happened is that this huge pressure to industrialize and grow the economy really fast, and also I remember when I was a student there, which is now in the late 90s, there was a huge thing about like the American dream, and everyone wanted to be American, basically, and that they wanted stuff. That I think that wanting of stuff has definitely come from a foreign influence, actually, and that hasn't gone away. But when I was researching Wabi Sabi, it was so interesting that even though I did talk to young people, that the real precious information came from older people. And some of them said that we feel that the younger generation really are going so fast through their life, they don't have time to think about these things. And I know a friend of mine, the guy who wrote the introduction to the book, Hidetoshi Nakata, who's a really famous ex-football player, he's now owns his own sake brand, and he went around over 200 sake breweries around, you know, all over the countryside to find the best sake that he now sells overseas outside Japan for Westerners, because he spent a lot of time overseas and kind of understands the different tastes and all that. He's spent a huge amount of his own time and money investing back in the sake community in Japan. He holds these like massive festivals in Tokyo to get young people into sake tradition, because of the culture's, we need younger stewards of culture. And I think that's an issue everywhere. But I think what you saw probably, even though, you know, Tokyo people of all ages are working like crazy, is definitely something to do with a generational thing. And I think there's things in our own culture that older people sometimes kind of hold on to better than we do. And we almost have to learn that, you know, like granny skills. And I'm like, oh, I really wish I knew these things about my, that my, you know, my granddad knows.
How
about
to like garbage, make stuff.
Yeah. Or you fix know, how things. To leave baskets. Suddenly you kind of get to a certain age and like, I really want to know all that stuff. It really matters. Whereas when you're 18, it's like, that's so uncool. And I think there's an element of that everywhere. And so absolutely, the thing with the word wabi-sabi is, firstly, it's not in the dictionary, which is so difficult to imagine an English word that we all intrinsically know and understand and is part of how we live, and yet it's we don't have a definition for it. And also the fact that nobody can really articulate it. And actually my what I've gathered in the book is really pulling together the things I heard from so many different places, and also just it's because it's really how I felt what people were trying to say without the words that they were using. And then when I've repeated it back to them, they were like, yes, yes, that's what it is. But the culture is one of those things, you know, there, you can't, and that's the danger of writing or talking about culture, because there is no one answer for everybody, is there?
No, there isn't. And so before you go any further, I should probably just ask you, so how would you describe wabi-sabi?
So for anyone who has heard of the word before and thinks it is basically a word which describes objects with a particular kind of beauty, which is an imperfect beauty. Mm. So like a wonky teacup or a you know, maybe a table that has like a really beautiful patina of age on it because it's you know, it's been worn down over the years, like a farmhouse table or those kinds of things. I think that's what a lot of Westerners say. Firstly, it's not the thing itself is not wabi-sabi. It's a feeling that you get when you experience that beauty and you subconsciously or consciously realize that that is a reflection of the nature of life. The thing that is the thing is getting more beautiful with age, which is actually the sabi part of wabi-sabi. It's beautiful because it's simple, which is the wabi part of wabi-sabi. It's beautiful because it's imperfect. The whole of nature is transient. This is a Zen principle. Everything is changing all the time, and that includes us. And if everything is changing, nothing can ever be complete. And if nothing is complete, nothing can be perfect. So we are all imperfect, impermanent, incomplete, and that is so far from what we're told in society, but it's an essential truth about us. And it's as soon as you realize that and actually kind of pay attention to what does that mean, like I am supposed to be a work in progress. I'm supposed to be imperfect, learning as I go. I'm not going to be here forever, so I should treasure my life. Everything that's happening to me is not forever, so the bad stuff is going to pass and the good stuff is going to pass too, so let's enjoy it. You know, you start to think about your life in a whole different way.
Yeah, it goes back to what you said right at the beginning about how we think that we don't like being learners, we don't like being beginners in anything. We all kind of want to come out the gate and be absolutely fantastic at something. And as you say, that's just not the case. That's not how it is.
It's really not. And I think even if you can you know, with social media, paint some picture of that you're like a brand strategist on day one, even though you've never had a brand or built a brand, you know, that might work for a while. But when you get actually deep into the weeds with your clients, they're going to figure it out, right? And so it's not to say don't try things. It's say just be open to learning as you go and understand that you're not going to have the same skills, experience and, you know, charging levels as someone who's been doing it for 30 years perhaps, or, you know, and it might be that, oh, well, I'm young and I'm bringing all these new ideas, and that's great, that's really great, but you also don't have to be the expert in everything from day one. And I think one thing in Japanese people are amazing at is being humble. And I think we can use a lot more humility these days and say, you know, this is what I can do, this is what I can offer, and this is where I'm going to grow, you know. And even if that conversation is only with yourself, you know, being realistic, it just, otherwise you set yourself up for kind of disappointment in yourself from day one. Like, of course you don't know it. So how can you expect to get those 10 clients straight off the bat when you don't have testimonials or whatever? You know, it's all of these things, they're step by step. And I think that just, it just gives you a lot of permission to take things at your own pace, whatever pace works for you, and to try and do things really well as you go. This is not about saying, oh, everything is imperfect, so I just do a shoddy job. That's not what it means at all. It means don't expect to finish everything, every single thing you could possibly do perfectly before you do anything else, is one way of looking at it, which I think is really important, because if you're a perfectionist, that often turns into procrastination. But also not expecting so much of yourself, which is completely unrealistic based on where you are in your life, you know.
I think that's so wise and so refreshing to hear, because I think it is a real issue in the wider world, and then also in our community as well, that kind of feeling of, and I know I definitely feel it, that, and I said before that I hate the fact that I feel like I have to appear like an expert, because I don't feel like one, and I really struggle with that. But I think it's something that a lot of us struggle with, and I think that that leads to us not going through the process of learning the skills that we need, because we try and fake them too much.
Yes, and I totally get it. Everyone's always like, fake it till you make it, and all this stuff. And then on the other hand, you've got this whole imposter syndrome conversation, and I totally understand all those. But for me, the first thing you can absolutely be an expert in is your own life. Like, you are the world's leading expert in your own life, your experiences, which are very real, the things that you've learned along the way, which are not things, you know, they might be things that you've learned from a textbook or from your education, but they're also a lot of things that you've learned about life. And spending some time, like, figuring out, what are those things? What do I know for sure better than anybody else, because I am living this life? So it might be some transition that you went through and how that affected you. It might be, you know, an addiction that you had that you came through. Whatever it is, there's something which you are the expert at. And realizing that gives you that seed of confidence, going, okay, I'm not an expert at anything. I'm expert in this, and then where can I go from there, and how can I use that to serve people in the world? And, you know, I think it's totally fine. If you're building a business, there's nothing wrong with starting small and celebrating your, first 1,000 followers or whatever. I mean, I don't get that bothered about numbers, but, some people do. And, you know, for example, writing a book, the publisher cares about numbers. So you can't be blasé to these things, you know, but celebrating those small steps along the way and realizing that, you know, it's a continuum. There are always people before and behind you. And so what you can bring to the table is incredibly valuable to somebody who knows nothing, even if you know a bit, right? But not pretending that you know everything, because then you're both going to be disappointed. So then working with somebody who knows nothing to do a really good job for them, and then you learn in the process, and there's your excellent testimonial to work with somebody the next step along, because you've also along. And I think recognizing that, this whole idea of being a work in progress, we're always growing, you know, at the beginning of your say, even in a job, at the beginning of the job, you have zero experience. You do that job for 5 years, you've got 5 years experience. Like, just literally by living and showing up every day, you're growing your experience. So I think it's recognizing that what you do have, which we often, I think, don't pay attention to. You know, we look at the job title and go, oh, I've just been doing that thing for 5 years. But actually, there's so much within that is valuable in other areas that we can kind of dig out, excavate, and turn into something else, you know.
I think it's really interesting when you work for yourself, you see, because I think when you have a job, a traditional job, you're told what you are and what your skill set is, in a way. Like, your job title is that description. I think that when you work for yourself, and I think one of the things I've realised over the last year or so is how many skills I've built up sort of around my main skill, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Purely because I've just had to do it for myself. And it's given me a much wider skill set, I think, than I would have had in any other, you know, in any traditional job.
Yeah. And it's interesting with what you do. So if you're a brand storyteller, it could be that you have been telling stories all your life. The bit about, you know, I'm not just talking about your specific situation here, but perhaps the bit about brands is something new, and that's the connection that you're now ready to make, and you're working with brands to help them tell the stories. But the storytelling piece could have been that's the narrative of your life. And so I think that's, as we, when we have our own businesses and we grow into these new shapes of things that we want to be, there is value sometimes of naming yourself kind of ahead of when you're ready, because that shows you what you want to grow into, but also recognizing the reality of where you are and understanding, well, what do I need to do or learn or drop or take on that's going to get me into that role that I'm creating for myself, and not just jumping in there going really loudly, I'm here, this is what I do, like actually build the skills and experience to back it up, you know.
Absolutely. I've just had a look at the time and realised we've been talking for quite a while. So I ask all my guests, what has been the hardest thing for you about living life a little differently?
I think it has been having to explain what we do over and over again. And what I found really interesting is that depending on whereabouts I've lived in the UK, I've lived all over the world as well, but it's specifically in the UK, people's understanding of the idea of doing what you love is very different. And it has taken a lot longer for me to explain what I do in certain areas of the country. And some people suddenly get it in certain communities, which is interesting. And I think says a lot about who you surround yourself with. In terms of just kind of, you know, following my heart and all of that, I think that's something that comes quite naturally to me. But we, you know, when my husband quit his job to come and work with us, and suddenly we had to, you know, there's a whole other salary to pay, and we just got married as he started the day after our honeymoon. In the company, and that was a whole thing to learn, like how do you work together as a couple as well as building a life and a family, and that's been a really interesting experience. But I think the hardest thing really is trying to explain to people who really don't get it, and hopefully some of those conversations have opened their eyes a bit as well.
That comes up a lot, I think. And I think because, and then a lot of people say they then sort of get a bit defensive as well, and they try and explain, and then they, and it's just, yeah, it's just, it can be really hard, I think. Definitely. So what has been the best thing for you?
I think the freedom is incredible. That's really important. And knowing that there's this real security, ironically, which comes with knowing that I made something from my brain and it's paid my mortgage, you know, and actually in a job, someone can fire you at any time, whatever. And of course, you know, things don't always work out in your business and you might lose a client here or that thing might not sell or whatever, but you have the capability to make something from nothing. And I think that is really powerful when there's things going on in the world that are quite destabilizing, to know that we'll be okay because we can do this. That I really love that. And also the fact that, like, I get to write books, and books that people tell me are changing their lives. I mean, that's completely not connected to income or work or anything. You know, that's worth spending my life on, you know. And also just the fact that I get to explore these really big questions about life and write about them and share them with the world, like with Wabi Sabi most recently, it just feels like a precious gift. And I'm grateful that sometimes I have taken risks and done the hard thing to get in a position where, you know, that's now my job.
Do you know what your next book is going to be?
I am in conversations. I can't say more.
Okay. Oh, exciting. Well, I look forward to hearing about it.
Yes. Hopefully there will be many more.
And where can people find you online, and where can they buy your book?
So I'm at bethkempton.com, or for any of my, what people have described as life-changing online courses, you can go to dowhatyouloveforlife.com, or you can come and look at my absolutely perfectly imperfect life on Instagram at Beth Kempton. And the book is available online, you know, Amazon and all independent bookshops. The American version isn't actually out until December 31st. It's a new version coming out with a lot more images, with a different publisher. But if you want to get it early, the beautiful European version with the gold foil and everything, you can get that from thebookdepository.com, and they ship anywhere in the world for free. So
amazing. I should say that you very kindly sent me a copy of your book before we spoke, and it is absolutely beautiful. It's one of those books that will be sort of sitting, once I finish reading it, it'll be sitting out on my in my living room, just sort of on the side, because it looks so gorgeous.
Oh, I'm so glad, Fiona. And I'd love to know, like, I know that you haven't finished reading it yet, but what's your kind of takeaway?
That it's so much bigger than I thought it was, I think.
Wabi Sabi.
I kind of knew that it was more of a philosophy than a sort of aesthetic choice, I guess. But I think it's just really interesting as someone, because I absolutely adored Japan when I was there, and it is a place I would really love to go back to. But it was one of those places where I always felt very much on the outside, and it always felt like everything was just a bit out of reach, and I couldn't quite kind of connect to stuff purely because of the language. Or most part because of the language. And so just sort of reading your thoughts on it from someone who has spent so much time in the country and who is able to speak the language and who really connects to it, and who has Japanese friends, was just really, really amazing. And I just absolutely loved it.
I'm so glad. I think that's the thing, you've managed to pull back that curtain even just a tiny bit and encourage hopefully more people to go and find out for themselves as well, but even just to appreciate a bit of those things that are buried by that thick layer of language, then my work here is done.
Absolutely. Beth, thank you so much for talking to me today.
It's been my pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy this episode, then I'd absolutely love it if you could rate, review and subscribe to this podcast. It really does help put it in front of other people who might like it. If you'd like to join in the conversation, then please do come find me over on Instagram. I'm at fbarrows. I'm almost always there and almost always talking about these sorts of subjects as well. You can also find out more about the work that I do, helping small creative businesses clarify their message and tell their brand story, on my website, www.fionabarrows.com, where you can also subscribe to my weekly newsletter, Letter and Notes. I share stories and insights from my own experience in living life a little differently every Monday morning. Until next time.